Ghoulish greetings, everyone. Those tunes you just heard are from Alien Manor, and I'm your host, Tessa Morrow. Welcome to the 300th episode of Paranormal Prowlers Podcast. Woohoo! Time sure flies. Thanks so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen, and wherever you listen from the scorching hot desert to the isolated island, the mountain towns and the big cities and just everything in between, it is greatly appreciated. Where will this week's big city shoutouts take us to? Thornton Heath, England. Old Bridge Township in New Jersey. Cittadella in Italy. Mackinac Island, Michigan. That was a good episode. You should check out the Mackinac Island. Governor, New York. And Tonopah, Nevada. And a big shout out to my ever so stellar voiceover family. Of course, we've got Thomas Janes as Paul Gray and a news reporter. We got Casey Morrow as Brianna Gray. Got Bryce Kolb as Slipknot's Sean Crahan and Corey Taylor. And we've got Sean Curtis as Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington. And then we got my buddy Jerry Cooper as Kirk Woodring. The shout-outs continue. Big shout-out to my music family, Alien Manor, Liar's Handshake, and Stick the Landing. So last week, you heard from Teresa, who had the pleasure of meeting Dimebag Darrell, Chi Chang, Scott Weiland, and Wayne Static. So this gal goes to concerts like no one's business. And if you remember in last week's episode, I even kind of made a comment saying, like, I need to hang out with you sometime. So a few days ago, I get a text from her saying, hey, your aunt and I are going to this 21 Pilots concert. Would you like to go? I have an extra ticket. Now, I hate to admit this, but I had never even heard of this band before, like ever. Like there's a lot of bands that I've heard of and I'm like, I've heard of them, but I've just never heard their music or, you know, whatever. We've all been there, right? Well, I was like, I've never heard of these guys, but I happen to have the money for the ticket and I have not been to a concert in years. So I was like, hell yeah, I'll go. It was such a great time. I had so much fun. And it was kind of like spontaneous, not ever hearing this band before. I even looked them up and I'm like, maybe I'll hear a few songs or whatever. I was like, nah, I'm going to be surprised. And they put on quite the show. It was really, really awesome. So, I mean, I was impressed. It was just so much fun. They actually did 29 songs. And it was like song after song. They didn't do any BS talking or anything. And so it was pretty cool. And at one point, on the screen behind them, they have this carousel going and it's like red and eerie looking and they're not carousel horses. They were like skeleton horses and it looked so epic. Like seriously, I was like blown away by that. Just had to throw that out there. And then talking about concerts, on September 28th, Lynyrd Skynyrd and ZZ Top are going to be performing like 40 minutes away from where I live. So I am going to that, which I'm super stoked about. And then on October 17th, which is closer to my birthday, my aunt, Rhonda, who was another one who invited me to the 21 Pilots concert, is taking me for my birthday to go see Godsmack. Pretty cool considering that in all my years, I've only been to two concerts and now in the next few months, I'll be going to three concerts. So pretty stoked about that for sure. Music is the soundtrack of your life. Dick Clark. All right, everybody, we are in the final episode for now in this Rock or Death series. In the past four episodes alone, I discussed several Rock or Deaths, including Murder, Orion, Car Crashes, The Exploding Hearts, and Chi Chang, Massacres, Dimebag Darrell, and the Miami Showband Murders, Plane Crashes, Randy Rhoads and Lynyrd Skynyrd, Ricky Nelson and the Stone Canyon Band, Electrocution, Keith Relf, Accidental Shooting, Terry Cake, Suicide, Wendy Oraline Williams. Drowning from Hurricane Katrina, Barry Cowskill. The Sunda Strait Tsunami, wiping out the band 17. Overdoses, Wayne Static and Scott Weiland. And in this final Rocker Death episode, we have so many more to go through. This brand new lineup starts right now. Is feeling. You can try to verbalize it. It really just hits you or it doesn't. Gene Simmons. First up is Slipknot's Paul Gray, also known as the Pig, and designated number two. Not only was Paul a bassist and backing vocalist, but he was also a co-founder for Slipknot as well. Besides Slipknot, he had also been in Sudden Infant Death Syndrome, Anal Blast, quite the name, Body Pit, and the Have-Nots. Busy fellow for sure. Now sadly, like so many that we see, Paul Gray had a problem with drug use. He was not in denial, he was actually pretty damn open about his addiction. He shared with grunge.com,
"I would spend half the time in the bathroom shooting up."
He also talked with them about their tour for their 2008 album, and he said that all hope is gone.
"I'd be trying to play, and I'd fall out of my chair a couple times and fall asleep in the middle of tracking a song. Once you get to a certain point with drugs, it's fucking so hard going through withdrawals. It's not that you don't want to quit, you just can't. Halfway through the record, I ended up going into rehab."
May 24th, 2010, Slipknot's Paul Gray is found dead in Urbandale, Iowa, at the Town Place Suites in his room, number 431. A needle and pills are scattered about. The autopsy showed that he died from an overdose of fentanyl and morphine. He also had traces of Xanax in his system. The following year, in 2011, Donnie Steele, a former member of Slipknot and one of the original guitarists, reunites with his former bandmates and fills in as bassist during Slipknot's 2011 summer tour. Paul, he's survived by his beloved wife and daughter, who sadly did not have the chance to ever even meet her own father. She was born in August, and you see, he died a few short months earlier, back in May. I can't even imagine what his poor wife went through when this was all happening. She lost her husband, and then she's like, "Oh my God, my baby's not even going to be able to even meet her father, hear his voice, see his face." Just so heartbreaking. Over 2 years later, after his death, Paul's doctor, Daniel Baldy, was charged with manslaughter that resulted in the death of Paul Gray, Slipknot's the Pig. He would not be the only death in question when it comes to this disgraceful Dr. Baldy. At least seven others were connected to him as well. Seven other deaths. The physician was accused of writing continually higher dosage prescriptions to Gray, starting in 2005 up until his overdose death, 5 years later, in 2010, he pleaded not guilty, and unfortunately, in May of 2014, he was found not guilty on every single damn account. At least eight people dead, and the dude walks free? So much for justice. Gray's wife turned widow testified in court, sharing that Baldy kept handing over prescriptions to her husband time after time after time, even though it was painfully clear and obvious that her husband had an addiction problem with the drug that was being prescribed to him. It's like this Dr. Baldy was Santa Claus. Just here you go, buddy. Here's another prescription for you. A settlement is agreed on outside of court, and a couple months later, the Iowa Board of Pharmacy permanently bans Baldy from being able to give any prescriptions, administer, or dispense controlled substances when it came to treating chronic pain. He still got off easy, if you ask me. Eight people linked to him. Eight deaths? Can you say serial killer? His wife turned widow, Brianna, can't make heads or tails of why her husband, who was taking medications for addiction, was taking something that he was highly addicted to.
I just knew it was his drug of choice, that he'd struggled with it, so I just wasn't really sure why he was on it, why he needed it along with the medication he was taking for addiction.
Yes, the doctor got off easy. Sean Crahan, a fellow co-founder of Slipknot, known as Clown and designated number 6, says this about his late bandmate and dear friend.
He was the kind of person in the band that really wanted everyone in the band to always get along and just concentrate on the band. He was a really great friend and just a really great person. He's going to be sadly missed, and the world's going to be a different place without him.
Corey Taylor, designated number 8, said this about Paul.
The only way I can sum up Paul Gray is love. Everything he did for everyone around him, whether you knew him or not. And that's what he left behind for us, his absolute love. I will always miss him with every fiber of my heart, as will everybody at this table, and everyone who knew him. He was the best of us.
After Paul's death, Slipknot went on tour, and they had a stand with the late member's pig mask and his jumpsuit, along with the bass guitar right next to it, in memory of their dear friend, gone way too soon, but not forgotten. Paul Gray, at the time of his death, was only 38 years old. One good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain. Bob Marley. You know, I kind of have to disagree with Bobbo there, because there are certain songs that come on and it just like reminds me of somebody who's no longer here, and I get teary-eyed, and sometimes by the end of the song, tears are just running down my face. It's not like I'm weeping, but they're just like, you know, coming down. So don't know about that one. Next up is somebody that I have been a fan of since I was a young child. I remember I would grab my Walkman before getting on the bus to go to school. I would throw those earbuds in and I would listen the whole trip to Soundgarden. My sister Jenna was Green Day, never been a fan of Green Day, never liked them. But me, I was Soundgarden. And I always dreaded going to school because I hated it just so incredibly much. But hearing Chris Cornell's voice in my ears somehow got me through the day. And if it weren't for Chris Cornell, I don't know what would have happened. The bullies were really bad, so I have to give him a big thank you for helping me out during those tough times. And he was not only a huge part of Soundgarden, but later on, Audioslave, with some of the Rage Against the Machine dudes, Temple of the Dog, and he was also solo as well, releasing several songs that were beyond kick-ass. A man of just so many talents, his voice was amazing, he was a phenomenal guitar player. And when his close friend Andrew Wood, lead singer of Malfunction and Mother Love Bone, dies due to a heroin overdose, it brings Chris Cornell to his knees in pure and utter heartbreak and excruciating pain. They weren't only friends, but they were roommates as well, and even recorded a song together. But sadly, Andrew died before they could do more together. Regarding his friend's death, this is what Chris Cornell had to say about Andrew.
I've always had a really difficult time with loss. I didn't deal well with Andy's death. After he died, numerous times I'd be driving around, I'd look out the window and I thought I saw him. It would take me 5 minutes to update to the moment and realize, no, he's actually dead. This tour, in a sense, is the dealing. It's facing the reality.
So there was a video that I watched years earlier about Chris Cornell talking about Kurt Cobain's suicide, and this is what he had to say.
When Andy Wood died, I couldn't listen to his songs for about 2 years after that, and it was for that reason. His lyrics often seem as though they can tell that story. But then again, my lyrics often could tell the same one. In terms of seeing everything as a matter of life and death, if that's what you're feeling at the time, then that's what you're going to write. It's sort of a morbid exchange when somebody who's a writer like that dies, and then everyone starts picking through all their lyrics. In Kurt's case, whatever he was thinking and whatever he was writing There wasn't an arrow pointing at what his demise was. It's a stream of thought. It's a possibility. It's definitely something that somebody was feeling when they were writing. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't either.
So it's pretty eerie hearing this coming from him, saying that they were feeling like this when they wrote it, and it doesn't mean it's going to happen, but then again, it doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen. And especially knowing what did happen, you see some of his songs and lyrics from both Audioslave and Soundgarden, both fantastic bands, like the entire song A Pretty Noose, which has always been one of my favorites, and then another phenomenal song, Nearly Forgot My Broken Heart, and other songs. But so a little under 2 years before Chris passed away, he wrote and released a really awesome song, that being, of course, Nearly Forgot My Broken Heart. And it features the actor Eric Roberts. Love that dude. And the music video brings us to an old West scenery, where both Chris and Eric are prisoners, and they're awaiting a date with the hangman. Chris is singing and playing his guitar in the jail cell, and it shows others being legally hanged as the song continues. And it's his turn, finally, and a woman distracts the hangman, so his execution is pretty much sabotaged, and he is forced to marry the woman who paid for his failed execution, who was the executioner's assistant. When it came to this particular music video, Cornell refused to have a stunt double. He wanted to conduct his very own stunts, which is dangerous when it comes to a hanging, right? The taping of this botched execution does not go as planned, and they had to do this several times. They had some sort of chemical liquid agent on the noose, and it gets rubbed onto his neck, and it left him with second-degree burns, I believe, on his shoulders and part of his neck as well. And less than a month after Chris Cornell's hanging death, this video is taken off YouTube. And while doing research for this episode, I did see that Vimeo has it up, and also YouTube did bring it back as well. So if you type in Chris Cornell, Nearly Forgot My Broken Heart official, it should pop right up for you. And it's quite the music video. It's a great song, spectacular, yet eerie, and a wonderful video. And I always appreciate that when it's a kick-ass song and the video is just as phenomenal. Like My Chemical Romance, The Ghost of You, that song is one of my favorites, but the music video is mind-blowing. It always brings me back to World War II days and makes me really think about my grandpa, both of my grandpas who served in World War II. So My Chemical Romance, The Ghost of You, check out that song. I know I went off track with that one, but then also, yeah, Nearly Forgot My Broken Heart. I really recommend you check that one out too. You will thank me, I'm sure. I'll wait to see your thank you note in the mail. And it's really kind of cool because Chris's son, who is then 10 years old, is in this video, Nearly Forgot My Broken Heart. He's the little boy with the long hair and he has these overalls on. And his dad, who's not Chris in this, but his music video dad, is about to be hanged. And it's just bone chilling, to say the least. In an interview in 1996, Chris opens up about depression and, yes, even suicide.
I know what it feels like to be suicidal, and I know what it feels like to be hopeless. There's some point where I learned enough about myself to know that I don't have the tolerance to create other hurdles as well. No one really knows what run-of-the-mill depression is. You'll think somebody has run-of-the-mill depression, and then the next thing you know, they're hanging from a rope. It's hard to tell the difference. But I do feel that depression can be useful. Sometimes it's just chemical. It doesn't seem to come from anywhere, and whenever I've been in any kind of depression, I've, over the years, tried not only to imagine what it feels like to not be there, but try to remind myself that I could just wake up the next day and it could be gone, because that happens. Not worry about it. And at the same time, when I'm feeling great, I remember the depression and I think about the differences in what I'm feeling and why I would feel that way, and not be reactionary one way or the other. You just have to realize that those are patterns of life, and you just go through them.
By the tender age of 13, Cornell's already using alcohol, marijuana, and LSD. He knew he had demons and he knew things had to change. He was not in denial. He worked his ass off. But sadly, 2 months before his suicide, he emails a friend telling them that he, quote,
would love to talk, had relapse.
Soundgarden was founded in 1984. I was just 2 years old. They were successful. They had made several records. They had sold out tours, millions of fans. But sometimes that's not enough, and they call it quits in 1997. Chris then went on to do solo projects, and he created Audioslave. Now, Soundgarden does get back together, though, back in 2016, after almost two decades of being apart. Fans were thrilled, including me. I was stoked. After the near two-decade hiatus, fans and the group themselves are ecstatic to be back. They had just started the tour. Little did people know that May 17th of 2017, they would be witnessing the very last show that Chris Cornell would ever participate in. The show ends 45 minutes before midnight on May 18th, and Chris Cornell has just finished performing at a show with Soundgarden at the Fox Theater. Things were looking phenomenal for the band. They were together again. They were on tour, which included 18 concerts, and they were working on a brand spanking new album. They were on cloud nine. But in Detroit, many cannot help but notice that Chris Cornell was not his usual self. AllThatIsInteresting.com gives us an unfortunate inside look to this very last final show.
One reporter who was at the show said he often staggered back and forth across the stage and seemed weak in his movements. Just one or two songs in, it was as if the energy has exited his body and what was left was the shell of a man scrambling to do his job.
AllThatIsInteresting.com shares more details from that haunting night, talking about how Chris Cornell is last seen by fans and band at 11:15 p.m. as he walks off the stage at Fox Theater, located in Detroit, Michigan. And he is accompanied by his trusted bodyguard, a man named Martin, who helps him to his room, room number 1136 of the MGM Grand. He helps Chris with a few other things before retiring to his own room nearby for the evening. Cornell used Ativan, which is an anti-anxiety in which he did have a prescription for. Martin gives him two doses as Chris had requested, and he heads out for the night. Or so he thinks. Meanwhile, back at home in Los Angeles, Chris's beloved wife Vicky cannot help but notice that the lights are turning off and on all by themselves. Chris has an app, like many of us do, on his phone, where you can control your lights, your air conditioning, and what have you, at home, from afar. And it was late enough that she was pretty concerned. Why is he doing this? And this results in her calling Chris. They have a discussion, they talk for a while, and it is very obvious to her that he's not well. He's talking, his words are slurred. He just does not seem okay. He is not his usual self. And she asks him, honey, what did you take? And he tells her that he took an extra dosage of Ativan. You know, this does not sit well with his wife. Husband and wife, they continue their discussion for a bit longer, not knowing this is going to be the last conversation they ever have together. And after they get off the phone, which I believe is close to midnight at this point, Vicky has this gut-wrenching feeling that things are not okay. She sits there. She's in Los Angeles, California. He's in Detroit, Michigan. They couldn't be further apart. She feels so helpless. She's replaying the conversation in her head, and the more she thinks about it, the more her stomach turns. He's drowsy. He's slurring his speech. He took a double dose of something. His last words he spoke to his wife before hanging up was this.
I'm just tired.
Vicky calls Martin, the bodyguard, and asks him to do a checkup on her husband. He does this, and he tries to enter the room, but Chris has the extra locks, including a latch lock, on the door, and he is unable to enter with his key. He lets Vicky know this, and the security is called. Security arrives and they straight up refuse to open this door. Vicky, she's desperate. She demands Martin kick down the door, which he finally does. This whole time, Vicky is on the other line. Martin's heart stops. He sees Chris's feet. And I can't help but think if the hotel security actually helped, if Chris maybe could have possibly been alive and maybe he would have been saved that day. Martin finds Chris Cornell with an exercise band around his neck and blood pouring out of his mouth. At 52 years old, Chris Cornell has died by a hanging death. The exercise band itself was attached to a carabiner, which had been shoved into the doorframe. Amazingly enough, the exercise band is not removed until after an MGM medic arrives at the scene at 12:56 a.m. This is a whopping 41 minutes after Martin had found Chris. Just, to me, that's mind-blowing. Like, are you fucking kidding me right now? While his cause of death is officially known as a suicide, several did cast doubt. Some believe the doctor overprescribed. Some believe other things that were proven not to be correct, so I'm not even going to talk about those. But what is known is that this man is gone way too soon. And I still listen to his music and enjoy his voice to this very day. Sadly, the anti-anxiety prescription that he had, one of the side effects, suicidal thoughts. And every time I go to visit family in Los Angeles, which isn't terribly often, but maybe like once every couple years or so, I always make it a point to stop by Hollywood Forever Cemetery and I visit my boy Chris Cornell. And this includes the actual year that he died. Rock and roll. Music for the neck downwards. Keith Richards. Next stop is another favorite of mine and actually has a connection to the last person we just talked about, that being the phenomenal Chris Cornell, and saying that many people are going to know who exactly I'm going to talk about before I even have to mention his name. Yep, next person up, Chester Bennington, lead vocalist for Linkin Park, Gray Days, and Dead by Sunrise. Bennington had it pretty rough as a young boy. He had loving parents, of course. His mother, she was a nurse. His father, he was a police detective. And they divorce when Chester is still pretty young. He's bullied badly at school. In his own words, he was
knocked around like a ragdoll at school for being skinny and looking different.
Ironically, his father, as a law enforcement officer, investigated child sexual abuse cases. And at 7 years old, Chester is sexually assaulted by somebody he considered a dear friend. He dabbles in alcohol and drugs at a very young, tender age, his favorite being opium, coke, meth, pot, and LSD. With LouderSound.com, Chester shared this.
I was on 11 hits of acid a day. I dropped so much acid, I'm surprised I can still speak. I'd smoke a bunch of crack, do a bit of meth, and just sit there and freak out. Then I'd smoke opium to calm down. I weighed 110 pounds. My mom said I looked like I stepped out of Auschwitz. So I used pot to get off drugs. Every time I'd get a craving, I'd smoke my pot.
Chester Bennington and Chris Cornell, they become very dear friends. They were extremely close, and after Chris died by suicide, Chester had shared on Instagram that he could not imagine a world without Chris Cornell being in it.
You've inspired me in ways you could never have known. I can't imagine a world without you in it. I pray you find peace in the next life.
On Jimmy Kimmel Live, Linkin Park, they perform one of my favorite songs, One More Light. And this was dedicated to Chris Cornell, his dear friend. And during Chris's funeral at Hollywood Forever Cemetery, Chester sings Hallelujah, and you could just hear the heartbreak, depression, sadness, and utter pain in this poor man's voice. And just 2 months and 2 days after Chris's suicide, on July 20th, 2017, which would have been Chris Cornell's birthday, Chester Bennington is found dead in his California home. Cause of death, like his dear friend before him, suicide by hanging. Chester had been severely depressed since the death of Chris. Truly heartbreaking ending for two spectacular spirits. Both of these men were married with loving wives, had children, were excruciatingly talented when it came to music, were popular, well-loved. Sadly, sometimes, that's not enough and suicide wins. I am into rock and roll because rock and roll to me means freedom. Ozzy Osbourne. These final two people that I'm going to talk about have a connection to somebody whose music you've been listening to these past several Rock or Death episodes. The one and only Zach Johnson from Stick the Landing out of Chicago, Illinois. Here you hear his voice now. His father, Dennis Johnson, was the bass player for the band Chase. Chase was a jazz rock band, and Bill Chase himself was a trumpeter. He came from a family who adored music, so it's really no surprise that Bill Chase and his siblings learned how to play instruments at a very young, tender age. He dabbled in several different instruments. He enjoyed them, but he really, really bonded and fell in love with the trumpet. Now, in 1971, Bill Chase founded the band Chase, and I listened to a sample of it myself, and it's pretty neat stuff. It consisted of four trumpet players, Chase himself, along with Jerry Van Blair, Ted Piercefield, and Alan Ware. John Mithyar was on percussion, Phil Porter on the keyboards, Angel South on guitar, and the Stick the Landing vocalist Zach Johnson's father, Dennis Johnson, he was on bass. And I did not even know about this particular band, Chase, until Zach shared with me that his father was the original bassist for the band Chase, and that he quit the band shortly before the deadly events that would take place, wiping out much of the band. The day, it's August 9th of 1974. The big news that day is Nixon resigning. The band, they are on their way to a county fair for an upcoming performance when tragedy strikes in the not-so-friendly skies. The Chase Band had left Chicago, and their last known whereabouts were in Waterloo, Iowa. They are in a Piper Twin Comanche, and it crashes in Jackson, Minnesota, killing Bill Chase, his current keyboarder, Wally Yon, drummer, Walter Clark, guitarist John Emma, and both pilot and co-pilot. There were no survivors. It crashed somewhere in the night in a soybean field. The Jackson County Pilot newspaper released this on August 14, 1974. Quote, plane tragedy near Jackson ends career of Bill Chase. The crash of a light plane Friday night just northeast of the Jackson Airport runway took the lives of six people, including four members of a rock band called Chase. The crash was discovered about 8:30 a.m. Saturday by George Warshek and Dave Deal Sr., who were looking for the downed craft. It was located approximately 300 yards northeast of the airport runway in a soybean field belonging to Leland Franson. The group was scheduled to play at a rock concert at the Jackson County Fair Friday night. The other four members of the group arrived by car, along with the road crew, and when the remainder of the group didn't arrive, they assumed they had landed at the airport in Cherokee, Iowa, where a similar plane had landed earlier. Killed in the crash were Bill Chase, 35, of Chicago, Illinois, leader of the group, Walter Clark, 25, drummer from Williamstown, New Jersey, Wallace Yon, 27, organist, Scottsdale, Arizona, John Emma, 22, guitar, Geneva, Illinois, the pilot, Daniel Ludwig, 41, Chicago, Illinois, and his secretary, Linda Swisher, 26 years old, Wheeling, Illinois. Four of the passengers were inside the craft, which did not burn, and bodies of the other two, including Bill Chase, were found outside the plane. Investigators said the victims appeared to have died instantly. The group took off about 2 p.m. in the twin-engine Comanche from Chicago, where they had filed a flight plan Friday. According to Dean Anderson, the manager of the Jackson Airport, there are flight service stations along the way. Our nearest one is Redwood Falls, where flyers may file flight plans. As soon as he reaches the next flight service station on his route, the pilot cancels so the ground control there knows he is beyond their station. Flight plans include each flight service station along the way, as well as estimated time of arrival. The plane was last heard from in a position near Waterloo, Iowa, at about 5:30 p.m. Friday. Anderson reported he heard an aircraft go over at about 6 p.m. An alert was issued for the missing plane from the Minneapolis Center about an hour after it had been last heard from. Chase had been together for nearly 3.5 years, although there had been several personnel changes within that time. The jazz rock group had recorded 3 albums entitled Chase, Enya, and Pure Music. According to the group's manager, Chase had been most popular in the Midwest and had performed at several concerts in Minnesota, including Worthington and Rochester. Jackson County Sheriff Jerry Benjamin said that, quote, everyone has their ideas on what happened, unquote. However, nothing has been forthcoming from federal aeronautics officials. Both Anderson and Benjamin noted that the crash would be studied and analyzed, and it would probably be a year or more before it would be released for public record. All officials had left Jackson Monday afternoon. Sheriff Benjamin commended such people as the Jackson Fire Department and Rescue Unit, Jackson Police, the ambulances, and all the guards for their assistance. The bodies of the victims were taken to Sioux Falls Sunday night and Monday morning and flown to their respective homes for burial. Unquote. Now here's a short bit from the official NTSB report regarding the accident itself. Quote, probable causes were pilot in command failed to obtain and maintain flying speed, improper IFR operation, inadequate pre-flight preparation, and or planning factors. Weather, low ceiling, rain, turbulence associated with clouds and or thunderstorms. And it's so sad that they were so incredibly close to the runway. Another thing was the pilot had poor communication skills when it came to the radio communications. It's right there. Use it, my friend. So I chatted with Zach trying to get his father on this episode, but timing just sadly did not work out. I made sure Bill Chase would be the final episode just to give more time, but dude is busy and I totally get that and respect that. But, you know, his father, Dennis Johnson, may be on a future episode talking about the band Chase, the band that was wiped from this earth way too soon. So keep an ear out about that. And like father, like son, Zach rocks it in his own rock band. To be a rock and not to roll, Led Zeppelin. And the final rocker that I will talk about is Kyle Woodring from the band Survivor. Zach's father, Dennis, was also in this band as well. So Kyle was a drummer for the Chicago rock band Survivor. He was formed in 1978, and they're still rocking to this very day, so that's pretty badass. They are best known for their double platinum certified 1982 hit, Eye of the Tiger, the theme song, of course, for Rocky III. Stick the Landing's Zach Johnson's father, Dennis Keith Johnson, was the bassist and drummer was Gary Smith. Both they were in Chase together. September 8th of 2009, Kyle Woodring commits suicide in his Lockport, Illinois home, leaving the community and his family, blood and music, completely heartbroken. His dear brother, Kirk, turned to social media and did a very heartfelt post about his brother just gone way too soon.
Kyle struggled for most of his life with depression. At times, his depression overwhelmed him. Despite all he had in his life, he was often unable to recognize his worth to the world. On September 8th, he succeeded in committing suicide. I feel helpless and saddened to not have been able to help Kyle in his last hours. I'm sure many of you share this feeling of guilt. I also know that those truly intent on suicide rarely reach out once they are committed to the act. In fact, the decision to act on these thoughts can bring about a sense of peace and calm. Depression is sometimes a terminal illness. I love my brother deeply and know how wonderful his life was. I will celebrate his light and know that the darkness is no longer present for him.
Again, keep an ear out in a future episode where Dennis Johnson may join me and talk about his time with the rock jazz band Chase and the rock band Survivor, both based right out of Chicago. Today, suicide was discussed a lot. In fact, almost everybody in this episode committed suicide. If you or someone you know has suicidal thoughts or tendencies, or are dealing with depression, please know you're not alone. Reach out to someone, a trusted friend, a family member, and call the suicide hotline today, which is 1-800-273-8255. And a big musical shout out to my musically talented family, Liar's Handshake, Stick the Landing, and Alien Manor. Another grand shout out to my voiceover family, of course, Thomas James, Casey Morrow, Bryce Kolb, Sean Curtis, and Jerry Cooper. Did you enjoy the Rocker Death series but did not hear your favorite rocker dude or dudette? Reach out to me at paraprowl@gmail.com and I'll make it happen. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Well, really, there's no need to cry, my friends. Just hit up any of those awesome podcast platforms such as Player FM, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Downcast, Castbox, Podcast Republic. You know what? Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone.
See you next week.